Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. The House Judiciary Committee, it's 10 minutes past 1. In attendance are Representative Lynn, Representative Coghill, myself, Representative Ramirez, Representative Samuels, Representative Holmes. We all care a great deal about children in this gathering, and we are here today to listen to an overview from Teresa Foster. Teresa? I believe, are we, that's our, I think.
You don't have your
backing.
Do I need to adjust that for any reason?
That's fine where it is. It's going
to.
Don't get it between you and the camera.
Teresa, today we are going to take up the subject of sex offender management overview as it relates to adult-on-adult sex offender crimes, adult-on-child sex offender crimes, and I hope that we can touch on the subject of juvenile-on-juvenile sex offender crimes as well, bearing in mind that many of those juvenile sex offenders grow up to be adult sex offenders if they go unchecked or untreated through the system. And we have some members that have other commitments because this is a Thursday, and we are ripening into the legislature. And for the benefit of the members, we're trying to allow for the speaker schedule, which is that we would be able to maintain Thursday meetings through the balance of February. Today is the 15th. Of February, so that would suggest that we would have one more Thursday meeting, and then as we get into March, we would open up into a more conventional schedule. And I will also say, just for the record, that Jane Pearson has been doing a brilliant job, and I couldn't be doing this job competently without her. Has been beating the bushes to get bills to this committee, and there really just aren't that many bills that are ready for hearing in Judiciary at this point. So. Just to give you an overview of where we're at. And so Vice Chair Dahlstrom has joined us. And with that, Teresa, we'd like you to go ahead and give us your name, your position. We also have John Boddock and Doc.
Department of
Corrections is on. I thought it was some casual doctor in the field. Department of Corrections is on the line. And I hope that we can maintain a robust conversation and one that's a little more casual today so that we can make a determination if there's something that we can do or several things that we can do to help this subset or these subsets that are in our community that are preying on young people and those that are more vulnerable, and that Teresa or any that you can also come up, and Mary Ann as well, and give us some direction that there may be some legislation that we can craft by the Judiciary Committee to assist in continuing to refine the manner in which we try to manage the offender population. So with that, Teresa, I will turn it over to you, and when you feel like you want to take a rest, we can get Mr. Boddock and the Department of Corrections online to have a robust conversation. And gentlemen, if you've got to go at 1:30, we'll be delighted to have you back if your affairs.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, just for what it's worth, I have a bill up in another committee. It starts at 1:30, so, and I'm the first bill up, so I'm just going to introduce it and let my staff go through the technical stuff, so I should be right back.
Yes, Representative Carter, we know you care about the children. God bless you for it.
And
you will. With that, Teresa, if you'll introduce yourself, and feel free just to be as free-ranging as you want in the subject matter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you and answer any questions and provide information. My job right now is I'm a special prosecutor with the Department of Law's Office of Special Prosecutions. And the position that I'm in was created about 3 years ago to have a person specially focus on sexual offenses, both children and adult, and serious domestic violence issues that would be connected with that. to deal with both training within the department and multidisciplinary training, some policy issues, as well as carry a specialized caseload from offices around the state when those cases are either too complex to be handled by the local offices or have conflict issues, which over the 3 years I've been doing this job, the conflict issues have unfortunately been cases where there are police officer sex offenders being charged by local offices. They've referred those to the Office of Special Prosecutions. And I started work in this field in 1981, worked in it for several years doing the same kind of work, left that field for about 15 years when my children were small, came back to it in 1998, and have been in this position with the Office of Special Prosecutions since 2003. I'm prepared to address, you know, whatever issues you have in terms of focusing specifically on the questions about sex offenders. Well, I guess before I get to that, I would like to just say that I've done a survey of our prosecutors around the state as best I can in the last few days in terms of how they feel about the new sentencing legislation that was passed last year, because it greatly impacts our work having the sentences for the sex offenses be so hugely increased. And the near unanimous feedback was that the Department of Law, the prosecutors are very happy with that. They're finding that to be a very effective tool. They expect that over time that will be, we will be able to measure a decrease in sex offenses merely by having some of these perpetual repeat offenders put in prison for a long period of time where they simply cannot be committing new offenses. That said, because the law is so new, there's very few cases that have been both charged and gone all the way through sentencing under the new law, so it's hard to know how that's going to happen and what that impact will be. What we're finding, though, in the short run with those, the change in the sentencing law, a lot of pressure from the defense to reduce charges or compromise cases to sort of avoid the first, even the first offense, low-level sex penalties are very high. Where we have evidentiary issues because of investigative problems, that's always been an option in terms of doing plea agreements, but it's our department policy that we're not going to be compromising cases in order to in any way avoid dealing with these high sentences. But that what that means in reality is there's going to be a lot more of these cases going to trial. The ones that are in negotiation process are staying there longer. It's becoming very difficult to resolve them. So we're expecting more of these cases to go to trial. What that requires then is we're going to have better and more complete investigations of both adult and child sex cases. Which feeds into the major problem area with that, which is investigative resources and better investigations. The numbers of our sexual assault cases outside the major municipal areas, such as Anchorage or Fairbanks, where we have police departments that have dedicated specialized investigators to these cases and can get good investigations. But the numbers of cases out in our rural areas exceeds in raw numbers the cases in our municipal areas. I won't give you all the numbers right now, but if someone asks for it, I can. In Bethel, for example, I looked at for the last 4 years just referred cases referred to the district attorney's office in terms of sexual abuse of minor and sexual assault cases. And the raw numbers out of Bethel, which the whole YK Delta, I believe, is approximately 30,000 people, compared to the Anchorage municipality, which is approximately 10 times larger. The raw numbers of these cases in Bethel is more than they were in Anchorage over that four-year period. But the police resources and investigative resources for them is vastly different. So,
pardon me. Representative Dahlstrom has a question for you.
Absolutely. Sorry if I didn't notice you.
No, that's fine. Thanks for being here. And before we get into some of the details of this, can you tell me, does the definition of a sex offender include someone who impregnates a minor? And if so, where that's written and the boundaries of that. And then also I would like to know if these minors who are impregnated by adults go for an abortion, is the person performing the abortion required to notify anyone, state, you know, local, whatever, that this sex offense has been committed?
Thank you. And through the chair, it is against the law to impregnate a minor if the participants are of the required ages under the sexual abuse of a minor statutes, which are found in 11.41.434 and forward. So if you have a 15-year-old who is being impregnated by a 22-year-old, just the sex act itself is a crime. The impregnating does not make it a separate crime. The second part of your question, as far as notification when there is an abortion, the physicians and people in their offices are mandated reporters. So if they are aware of the facts that make it a crime, they are mandated reporters and do need to report it. There's been a lot of stuff in the press lately and information circulating that some facilities do not ask the name of the partner, the male, to avoid putting themselves in that position. I'm not prepared to speak to whether that's common, just anecdotally unusual, or what. I just know that's a subject that's been presented as a concern, that if they don't ask, it's kind of a don't ask, don't tell concern.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So if they don't ask and don't tell, is that in itself breaking a law?
I don't believe that it is. I don't know if there's some medical standard that's not being met by not getting that information. I couldn't speak to that, but I don't believe there's a legal obligation to ask how old the partner is.
Follow up. One last question. If other groups that may be involved with helping the minors through these situations and giving counseling what their options are they required by law to notify anyone legally that this crime has taken place against this minor?
Through the chair, thank you for the question. Unless they fall within the mandated reporter statute qualifications, and I don't have that in front of me, but there's a listing of people and professions that are required to disclose, even if it's an otherwise confidential relationship. And that does include physicians, it includes psychotherapists, it includes OCS workers, it includes law enforcement. It does not include prosecutors, although certainly there's an encouragement to report among a lot of professionals who are not required. But your mandated reporting statute would be the place that would identify those people. And if you're aware of other professionals that are not covered by that, that are having regular contact with the victim population you're concerned about, I think the question to be addressed would whether you would want to add to the list of mandated reporters.
Are school teachers, school administrators?
Yes. Yes.
Considered in that? And how about groups that are 501c3s, such as, no matter what side they're on the issue, if they're Right to Life or if they're Planned Parenthood or whatever, are they required?
I can't with confidence answer that just because they're a nonprofit that deals with that. I'd be glad to look it up and follow that up and let you
Great.
Know. But I'm sure some of the organizations that may be providing certain kinds of counseling services, if they meet the definition of the therapist, could be. But I guess I can't say if it covers all nonprofit employees without taking a look at that statute.
And for the record, Mr. Chair, my concern is because I want these perpetrators off the street, not causing harm to others.
May I say, Teresa, before you continue, my friend, our friend Representative Newman is here, and he sent me a note. Mark, you're a great legislator, but not an excellent printer. There is a four-year separate mandate to determine the ability to prosecute, and I may want to ask about that. Does that, am I framing that question the right way, Teresa?
If I understand the question correct, Mr. Chairman. It used to be that it still is that for most purposes, the age of consent to sexual activity is 16. And it used to be that there had to be a 3-year differential between the person who was under 16, usually the female, and the perpetrator. There had to be a 3-year differential. Last year, the statute was amended to make that a 4-year differential. So the offender has to be at least 17 and at least 4 years older than a person who is under 16 for that to be covered. So a 16-year-old boy having sex with a 14-year-old girl by consent at this time is not an illegal act.
And we're going to lose Representative Samuels in just a few minutes. And Representative Newman, we know that these issues and Jessica's Law, these sort of things are very important. You're passionate about this. We'd be delighted if you'd come up and join us when we have a vacant seat. You'd be very, very welcome. Very welcome here. Yeah, I think Representative Grunberg's coming
shortly.
But
thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have to chair a committee at 1:30, but. Again, as you stated, this is very interesting to me as a representative who carried this in the House side last year. I've seen this and wanted to be here to see, participate as much as I could.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to have you here. And if your committee meeting ends early, we'd invite you to come back and to participate with us. Teresa, please continue.
I guess in the interest of splitting hairs, just to be correct about the last example I gave of a 16-year-old boy and a 14-year-old girl, I said that was not illegal if it's by consent. It could be, however, if they were brother and sister and that's an incestuous relationship. There are other statutes that might cover it, but the normal sexual abuse of minor statutes would not. So I want to make sure that that's clear. The other area that I was wanting to talk about in terms of directing towards your concern of sex offender management, again, I have to go to things that I see out in the rural areas because part of my job does have me helping out some of our smaller offices in the rural areas. One of the big problems we have is that that's where a vast majority of our sex offenders are. Historically, we've gotten a lot lower sentences in some of the rural areas for a lot of the sex offenses, and so they're coming back to the communities sooner. One of the concerns is there's almost no sex offender treatment available outside, there's not in the facilities right now, but there's not sex offender treatment available in most of those communities.
Can I stop you there and ask a couple of questions myself? Just yesterday, on the House floor, Representative Meyer very ably carried a whammy bill to double, the medical doctors that we can train and have here in Alaska. And you know, on the floor, we talked about the lack of trained medical professionals. Senator Bundy and I attended the Sex Offender Management Policy Conference in Little Rock, and right there in the Little Rock Gazette was the lack of medical doctors and medical professionals in Little Rock. And then the subject matter of the conference talked about how unsuccessful psychiatric treatment is for an offender population relative to acute psychiatric treatment to deal with the sexual disorder therapy, I guess, or whatever is the medical term. And so it raises the question here, where our resources are even more remote. How in the world are we going to offer treatment to, you know, this significant population? California manages a population of 100,000 registered sex offenders. There are 4,000 alone in the community of San Diego. I don't know how large our registered sex offender population is here in Alaska by, you know, several of the larger communities or some of these larger regions. But it raises the issue of how many registered sex offenders do we have? How many do we estimate the population is that haven't been, you know, the undiscovered offender population? What kind of a treatment program we have? I think Senator French told me, as great an advocate as we all are of the polygraph as an effective tool to manage that population, that we have one trained polygraph expert in the state of Alaska for sexual offenders. We don't have, even if we have an excellent plan, we don't have any resources to execute the management of a plan. I mean, it'd be like agreeing, okay, let's all agree we're going to do an aerial wolf hunt, but if we don't have any shooters and we don't have any helicopters and we don't have any rifles, doesn't matter how effective we think that would be in managing the ungulate problem. I'm not suggesting that we shoot offenders, but I would certainly find a lot of empathy out there for that kind of a program, although it's likely unconstitutional.
Mr. Chair, just some random thoughts. I don't know the number of registered sex offenders. I'm glad to try to find that number for you. If you look at the, you can sort through the sex offenders on the website by zip codes, and you will see that many of them are out in rural areas. And there might just be, in one community of 200 people, there might be three or four. The delivery of services, as we all know, if we've lived in this state more than 30 days, the delivery of services outside of the hub areas is extraordinarily expensive. People who do sex offender treatment are specialized people, whether they are medical doctors or psychiatrists or other kinds of therapists. It's a specialized field. It's not very popular, from what I'm told. A lot of people don't seek to go into the work of treating sex offenders, either inpatient or outpatient. But it's hard to keep those people employed out in an area, one where there might not be a large number of them, or they're in places that are so remote, you may need to stay in like a hub rural area like Bethel and fly out to the communities. So it's expensive to deliver, not popular with the professionals, and as with everything else, we don't have everybody concentrated in one place so that we can have an efficient delivery of those kind of services, however we decide they should be done. What I'm finding, and what our prosecutors find, is that many of the judges just don't even order sex offender evaluation and treatment as a condition of probation for many of these offenses because they say it's futile, and they're unwilling to require that they, for example, they go to Spring Creek for their time, to require that they stay somewhere where there is a therapist until they complete it before they can return to their home village. They're for the most part unwilling to make that a requirement because it could be years of treatment before they come back. So we're having the place where the largest number of our sex offenses are taking place, the location where we're not even sometimes getting that as a condition of probation.
Representative Lynn?
How effective is the treatment? And what's the return rate on these people committing a similar offense again?
Through the chair, I've read many studies and heard many presentations about this, and it's all over the map. There is some belief that certain kinds of treatment, which is behavioral focused and cognitive or thinking errors focused, is more effective than other kinds of treatment. It is not, I don't know of anybody who will say that this is curable. What you can do sometimes is have enough controls on a person to keep them from acting on their desire to have inappropriate sexual contacts. That's the best. Most of the studies, however, are measured success by recidivism rates, meaning how often does somebody reoffend after they've been through a particular kind of treatment. And most of those studies that I've been made aware of are using a 3 to 5, occasionally 8-year measurement period of reoffending. Well, during the first part of that time, some of them are actually in jail. So that time, we're hoping they're not reoffending. So we've got short measurement periods afterwards. And with sex offenders who offend over a lifetime, I don't believe that studies that say that there's a lowering of recidivism rates significantly, if their study times are less than 10 years, is very persuasive to me. The other part of that is that we know from other studies, lots of them, that many sex offenders commit, have multiple victims that are never disclosed and never caught. We're beginning to get some idea of the immensity of that by some of the polygraphing and things that are happening. So all we know with the recidivism study is they have not been caught and arrested for another offense. It doesn't tell us anything about whether they are offending.
Representative Lynn, at the conference that we attended, the numbers that were thrown around us that the recidivism rate is 16%. Only 16% among the less tier 1, tier 2, tier 3, under the less prone, the not the violent sexual predators, and they found that with intensive treatment, I found it to be like Freakonomics, to be honest with you. They cited a recidivism rate of 16%, that with intensive psychiatric treatment it was reduced to 12%, and then they paused and said, however, 84% of sexual offenses go unreported, and in large part, and this goes right to rural Alaska, which are some of the questions that I'd like to ask you, Teresa, is one of the biggest things that was cited at the conference that we attended is that there's often a tremendous lag between when a sexual offense takes place and when it's reported, because many of the people who are the victims will not report a crime until they are in a different environment where they feel safe. And so if you are in rural Alaska And if you are victimized by an offender and that offender is allowed to stay in that community or is going to return shortly to that community, and or if you stay in that community and you're subject to the stigma that comes with living in a very small village where anonymity is not a variable that enters into the equation, then an enormous amount of the offenses go unreported. And one of the other things that we discussed was I think it was Iowa did a 2,000 foot rule around schools, and it was lauded. You know, it was one of those bills that, like in our body, that will pass unanimously, and then they rescinded it several years later because they found that it had two unintended consequences. One is it made the general public feel more safe, as if we knew where sex offenders were and where they weren't. And the second one is that they disappeared. It drove them underground. That society has a better chance when if the offender population isn't locked up, which would be everybody's a choice, oftentimes. But if they're not locked up, then they're better. They're better off when they have a job and they have a stable place to live. And oftentimes, the sex offender doesn't live within 2,000 feet of a school. He lives within 3 feet of the bedroom of the victim that they're offending. That is so often the case. And I think, pardon me for sharing this with you, Ms. Foster, but you and I talked on the airplane when we flew down the other day, but the percentage is in the 90s, I think 93%. There's only about as much as the high-profile cases enjoy the attention of being abducted off of a street corner into a van or something heinous but kind of glamorous in that way, in a sick way, it's 93%, 94% of the sex offenses happen between where the victim and the predator know each other. They're either a family member or a close friend of the family, and it's in the high 90s, which contributes to some of the lower recidivism rates, is they're just simply run out of access to a population that are directly around them. Am I doing pretty good in regurgitating facts, because you're the expert and I took a 1.5 day conference?
I don't recall the number. I think if you include both adult and child sexual abuse, the vast, vast majority is among people who know each other. And of course, you've got the family situation with the children or an uncle or a grandfather. With adults, it's often what they call acquaintance sexual assault, where they have a short acquaintance. They've met at a social event or introduced by someone was a friend. So I think that percentage has probably got some accuracy in terms of the closeness. As far as the exclusion zone issues and stuff, I've not yet seen anybody find more benefits to problems with those kind of proposals, some of which you've set forth and that I would agree with.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So when it comes to prosecuting, one of the things I'm always interested in is once you actually take and get the resources to make a charge, what does that look like when it comes to prosecution? Is evidence your issue? Is it that family members, for example, won't level a charge against each other? Is it reduction of charges? What are some of the things that happen now that you've had a 3-year look at it?
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, what I'm not sure this is directly responsive to your question, but what I'm thinking of when you're saying that is, when we get a referred case from the police officer and we make a decision whether we have the basic elements of the offense there that allow us to have probable cause to bring a charge, that does not necessarily translate into a case that we can prove beyond a reasonable doubt once we get to trial. And especially with sex crimes, both adult and child, one of my main training themes with both law enforcement and medical personnel and prosecutors is to corroborate the statement of the victim with extraneous evidence. Because what happens in these cases, it's an expression I'd like to wipe out of our vocabulary, is he said, she said. But But that's at least worth using for our purposes, that it is the statement of a person versus the statement of another person, whether something happened or whether it happened with consent or without consent. We find when we are able to take the time to follow up that initial disclosure and corroborate the information that the victim is saying in terms of all these surrounding details and pieces of the puzzle, it builds a much stronger case. And that's what either is done before the decision is made to charge, because once we get the case, we don't have to charge it immediately. We can hold on to it and get follow-up investigation before we take it to the grand jury. That's where the law enforcement issue becomes a problem, because they are often going on other cases. And the kind of corroborations that's needed to build these cases better is often what they used to call gumshoe work, just interviewing lots of people who have individually little tiny pieces of the puzzle, interviewing a lot of the offender's friends, because they may be able to discount things that we know he or she may have said. It's tedious work, and that's in addition to the stuff that's on TV, all the CSI stuff and all the, you know, the DNA and the, you know, video, those kinds of things. But yeah, just going back to a place and maybe getting a video if someone says he's stopped at a Quick Stop and those type of things. But we need to get more information than just usually comes out in the initial disclosure to be able to carry that case all the way through prosecution. And when we can't get it from law enforcement because of lack of resources or lack of response, those are the cases that we know are righteous cases, that they happened. But because of concerns about the level of proof, we may be willing to compromise it to a plea to something lesser than that in order to have some accountability for the victim.
One of the things that we've done for children in Alaska is we've got these children's advocacy centers that has allowed information to kind of bring the child to a center where all the information is discerned. In other words, we're not abusing the child over and over again. For example, we don't take them to the doctor and then to the social worker and then to the... So that works fairly well, I think, in the areas. I think there's one in Bethel, if I remember correctly.
There is.
So is that a model that we can use for adult on adult as well? Is that a value?
I'm sorry. To the chair, I apologize. We do have a model, and the CAC model, Child Advocacy Centers, is great. And when it's working, there's nothing better. And working means having all the pieces in place and all the component agencies having their own specialized people using it properly. We do have something comparable. We have our sexual assault response team, which is a multidisciplinary approach to handling adult sexual assaults that has some commonalities, which is we get a victim advocate, law enforcement, and the medical provider all to come together, usually at the place of the medical exam, and do the joint interview to get the information that medical people need for their medical purposes, but the same theory of the CACs. There's differences in the cases, but it's a comparable model, and that is also considered best practices in that field for investigation.
Let me pursue this a little bit. I have so appreciated the Children's Advocacy Centers that I've been vocally supportive. So when you say you have a working model, is that that you would use hospital facilities and bring the whole team to a facility? Would you tell me a little bit about? I think that the barrier to people coming forward might depend on how they perceive they'll be treated when they step up and say, I've been abused. And so I'm trying to find, in my mind, how our system works in that regard.
And you're asking about the sexual assault response team model? Those are actually functioning in most of our large communities and a lot of our smaller communities. We have more functioning SART teams than we have CACs at this point. It is considered a best practices approach. Different places handle them differently. For example, in Anchorage, the municipality runs the SART program. In some places, it is the hospital. In other places, it's a department of the hospital, like the emergency room. But in all of them, they will have a facility set up similar to what's in the CACs, which is a private room for interviewing. We're not so focused on the child-friendly issues as we are with the children, but it'll be a private place that's a comfortable setting where the victim advocate can meet alone with the victim for a period of time before the exam is done and before the interview is done. And then the exam is done by nurses, usually. Sometimes it's nurse practitioners or even medical people. But most of our sexual assault response teams are staffed by what are called sexual assault nurse examiners, or SANEs. So you'll sometimes hear the term SART-SANE programs. And the nurses have been specially trained in all aspects of not only the physical exam, the collection of forensic evidence, but victim trauma issues and responding to that and providing aftercare, doing follow-up exams to confirm if their findings were an injury or not, similar to the medical exam of the child.
Sir. And what I'm, the reason I'm asking about this, first of all, how well that's working, and it sounds like in some areas it's working fairly well, and some areas probably could use some revving up. But what do we find out in those areas? And I'm concerned about those who will not come forward for a whole range of reasons. If they knew that there was a reasonably operating SART team, maybe they would feel more comfortable. Is that unknown information? Is it fairly well-known information? Have we learned anything from the best practices that in interviewing those who have had to be there on it's working, it's not working, this really didn't work good? Have we learned any lessons since now you've been there 3 years? I'm really, in my mind, I'm thinking you've been there 3 years, you've had a chance to look at it with a fair degree of fresh eyes from this position. So I'm kind of looking for what are the barriers that maybe we might be able to address from this perspective? For example, the evidentiary issues, how the court treats it over against how the prosecutor might deal with it. And I think that those kind of connections, not that I think there should be a total alignment of purposes, but there should be an alignment of resources.
Through the chair, a couple of things. My eyes are somewhat fresh, but not quite as fresh. I'm saying that because I started in the Department of Law in 1981 when the state was very first discovering that child sexual abuse existed and was very first finding ways to handle the sexual assault stuff and forming special units in our large offices, and I was able to help form the one in Fairbanks at that time. And then I left the field for a number of years and came back to it. And one of the main differences when I came back to it was the SART program. We did not have that in 1981. So in that regard, I have a fresh approach from 1998 of seeing it, and then the last 3 years in sort of a overview position. But I can compare it to what we were doing before. And at the time before, we had a lot of energy because we were all young and this was new and cutting edge stuff and we were going to save the world. But especially with the advances of technology in terms of the forensic evidence that's out there and the expectation of jurors, the SART programs have been really helpful in helping us get, in a way that does not further traumatize the victim, the medical exams that we need. They use some of the same equipment, which is a culposcope. It's a camera on the examining equipment so that we can photograph these injuries that are often very small. And have nurses specially trained to do that and also to testify. In terms of victim response, we still hear from our shelters, and almost all communities of several hundred or more have some kind of shelter or safe home program. There's more of those even than CACs or SART programs. They're still telling us there's many who do not report. The difference with the adult and child cases is the adult victim can choose not to report this. They may go to the shelters for services and get services for being a rape victim, but they can choose not to report. When that report is made at the hospital or medical facility, because many victims do want a medical exam, if they choose not to be interviewed by law enforcement, that's also their choice. But then the state-funded SART kit for collection of evidence and protocols don't come into play then. That victim is just seen as a medical patient. And we're now in the process with some of our SART teams of trying to follow a new military model for What do we do if they change their mind 3 days later and they do want to report and we've lost the opportunity to collect the forensic evidence during that exam? So we're in the process of working out protocols in some of our teams to do that. But the victims are finding and I think reporting that going through that SART process, similarly with children, is it's better for them, they're more supported, they're hooked into an advocate earlier who can follow them through. The prosecutor is not part of that team, but they sit on a multidisciplinary regular meeting, so we work together with them even though the prosecutor doesn't show up at the exam or the interview.
But while the chairman's busy, one of the things the Fairbanks Police Department told me is because of them collecting evidence, and they have to hold on to it for quite some time, generally over a period of years, they start having logistical issues, storage problems, because just the room temperature, security, and integrity of all the evidence. Big issue is. Do you find that to be true in other areas as well?
I do, Mr. Chair. I do find that, and I've also had occasion to talk with the Fairbanks Police Department about that. Because prior to this particular job, I spent 2 years as the district attorney in Fairbanks, and one of my particular issues was that a lot of our domestic violence and sexual assault and child sex abuse cases that we couldn't make at that time. We know these guys reoffend, and I was asking them to hold on to their evidence even longer than their own protocols called for. And we both agreed that would be a wonderful thing, so it wasn't that they were hostile to it, but the same response. We don't have enough room to keep it all. Do you want us to keep all the bedding we collected as well as just the samples that were taken? And it's a tension there in the field, but certainly space and storage, and especially with juror expectations being so high for having forensic evidence is at a premium, and I'm sure the local departments could use help in being able to do that.
Let me move a little bit, and then what I'd like to go to a little bit is Mr. Boddock and Department of Corrections about the implementation of the polygraph bill that was passed last year and is scheduled to be implemented in 08. But before we do that, would you give me an overview, because we can. It's such a broad and vast area. There's so much to discuss, and what I'm interested in is talking about a little bit about the tools that we have to better manage and measure this population. Would you tell me, and then I'll share with you what I learned at this conference about the way that we identify our sex offender population and the way that the offender registration works on the internet, you know, where you can check and see how many offenders and what their names are and where they live. Can you talk about that a little bit and tell me whether we have a distinction between at this conference we learned about three tiers, tier one, tier two, and tier three, but I don't know if that's state by state or whether that's universal, but that had to do with exhibitionism was tier one, fondling was tier two, penetration was tier three. Can you talk to me about the way that the registry is assembled and how we manage that registry a little bit? And then maybe we'll go to Mr. Boddock and learn a little bit about the polygraphs and how we're using that particular dynamic to better identify and manage the population.
Mr. Chair, there's not, as far as I know, any kind of tiering of sex offenders in Alaska in the way you're speaking of in terms of their registration. The statutes provide two types of registration for, in general, there's some exceptions, but in general, B felony sex offenses and below and single sex offenses, there's a 15-year registration period, which doesn't begin until after they're off probation. So they are registered as soon as they're out of the correctional facility, but the 15 years starts when they're off probation, so it actually could be a longer period. And then everybody else is lifetime. So. And that really can depend on either the severity of the offense, one severe offense, or more than one of other sex offenses. That's the only thing like tiers. On the registration that you see, when you call up the website, they will say what the person's offense is that they're registered for. I don't see that they always list all of their offenses. They just show the one for which they're registered or the most recent. I don't know how that decision is made by the people who manage that, but I usually often only see one. Even people I know have had multiple offenses. but there's not that tiering of more serious and less serious. And one quick other point I would just say that came to my mind when you said that, we are getting so much more evidence now of crossover sex offenders. We used to think people just stayed in one category and he's just an exhibitionist, or he just likes to peep in windows, or he just likes 12-year-old girls, or he just likes women to tie up. Or this, we used to think if you liked girls, you didn't do boys. The evidence is out there that we are wrong on that. And so I think to have a system of classifying them by the type of offense becomes a little risky for management.
So for the benefit of the committee, will you also touch on one of the most disturbing things that you shared with me was that the ability of sex offenders to mimic, I think that was the word that you used, high-functioning adults, so that they look like they're productive members of society, and these are often the undiscovered part of the offender population as opposed to the unstable part of the population that can't hold a job, that's a more visible, the type of offender where you can look at somebody and almost physically assess somebody to say, oh, well, there's something wrong with that person or their behavior. But you had talked about a significant offender population that mimics being a very good community citizen. I assume that these are the ones that become I didn't want to speak disparagingly, but yeah, the Boy Scout leaders, and become the staples in society, the gym teachers, and then you find out later. Can you talk about that a little bit, please?
Well, I think what we were talking a little bit about in terms of what you had been trained in is there's a belief that, there's a couple of things that play into that, that people who commit sex offenses have different sexual motivations, and things that they choose to do are different from what we call normal. These are abnormal sexual interests that we've made illegal to act on. But there's a lot of belief that since many sex offenders, when they come before the court for the first time, can come in with having had a good job, lots of family and friends saying, oh, I would never have believed it, and maybe still don't believe it, surrounding that person, that's almost the profile of a sex offender, is that they're just a normal person like all the rest of us. It's true that we can't spot them walking around, that they come from all walks of life, all socioeconomic. I mean, I think we comfortably know they're from every walk of life profession. My comment was that I don't accept that they are normal, that they are able to act normal, they can mimic normal. Many sex offenders are married and still go offend against children or against a person of the opposite sex in a violent way or things of that nature. But I don't believe that they are normal and just have this bad behavior over here. I think they are not normal. But they are able to blend in very well, which I think makes them very dangerous.
What can we do? Can you, and if you want to beg off on this for a few minutes, and we can talk to Mr. Boddick, but do you have one or two suggestions? Marianne, if you want to participate in this exercise now or in a few minutes, we'd be delighted. But if you have a couple of suggestions that this committee could take up and draft a subject matter that we could take up in this legislative session that would be helpful in identifying, managing, or better prosecuting, or better treating, although that's kind of my last choice. I'm not a great believer in treatment programs, just after what I've learned. We'd be delighted to have you point us in a couple of directions where we can get with Annie and the Department of Law and Ledge Legal and really try and draft some tools that would be helpful to the programs you work with, or Ms. Henry, the groups that you work with. So if you have something that you'd like to offer right now, or we can speak to Mr. Boddick, and then in about 30 minutes, I'd like to use the last 30 minutes of the committee hearing today to really discuss what kind of tools we can put in the law enforcement toolbox to help this year to better manage that population is something that we can offer as a Judiciary Committee. And I spoke to Senator French, and he has expressed a great interest to continue to work on this subject matter. It's he spent a year prosecuting sex offenders, and he said it was about it like equivalent to spending a year in a toilet is what he said, and so he's very interested in this particular subject matter. I know it's a million miles away from ethics and the longevity bonus and other things that we have to consider, but this is such a vulnerable subsets in our community that I'm just very interested in learning about it today, but coming away with this with some grist that we can, you know, make into something meaningful as we move along. So if you have something right now, or if you want to take 20 or 30 minutes and we can spend some time with Mr. Boddick getting an overview of the polygraph bill, whatever makes you more comfortable.
I have some generic thoughts. I think it might be helpful if you spoke with Mr. Boddick and I just think about it some more. And would you like
maybe you can sit with Ms. Henry, and if you two want to visit, and you're welcome to go back into my office and sit back there and kind of get on the same page. But we really would benefit greatly from that. So, okay, thank you very much. Mr. Boddick, are you with us?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chair.
Great. And who is who? Would you say state who you are, and is there somebody there with you? Is this Stu or... is there somebody else there with you?
My name is John Boddick. I'm an assistant attorney general assigned to represent the Department of Corrections. I would be characterized as general counsel for the Department of Corrections. With me is Deputy Commissioner Sam Edwards, Deputy Commissioner Dwayne Peoples, and Director of Probation and Parole Donna White.
Welcome, gentlemen. We're glad to have you. Would you begin by telling us about the implementation of the polygraph bill that was passed last year? How we're doing on that? I understood either from here in the building or from Senator French that we only had one trained polygraph expert in this area, and how we're doing on that, and then maybe give us a broader sense of how we treat sex offenders. And I'd like to give you about 20 minutes to share with us, and then maybe in the last and then in the ensuing 10 minutes. Give us some recommendations of what we can do legislatively or through statute to try and put more tools in your toolbox so that you can better accomplish your jobs in protecting the general public from this dangerous population. So with that, we'll kind of open it up to your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you will, I have Mr. or Deputy Commissioner Edwards here to describe the status of the department's program, and after he's done, I can discuss some of the legal issues that are being encountered.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Through the chair, this is Sam Edwards. We have what we're using is the containment model, which is a three-part treatment, supervision by a probation officer, and the polygraph as the third leg of that. A couple things that were mentioned earlier in testimony. One was that there were very few treatment providers in the rural areas, and actually there are no certified treatment providers in the rural areas. They are limited exclusively right now to the primary communities of Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, and Kenai. And then another that was mentioned was whether it was one polygrapher that was certified in the state for sex offender polygraphs. There are two individuals that I'm aware of that are certified. Neither of these individuals in state have the requisite number of sex offender polygraphs completed so that they could function on their own. What we're using right now is a polygrapher from Washington who flies up and does the polygraphs that we're using for the pilot program right now. What we're doing, obviously both these, the number of treatment providers and polygraphers are critical to the program's implementation July 1st. We are going to the university now and offering a training program, a certification program for certified counselors, master's degree counselors now for sex offender treatment providers. That looks promising right now. That one would, depending on their experience and their area of expertise, could enable them to be certified after a two-week training period for sex offender specific, or would require that they go and have supervised treatment sessions before they would be certified. And what we're looking at with the polygraphers is a way to have our in-state certified providers be supervised by an out-of-state polygrapher until they have the requisite number of successful sex offender polygraphs completed. And that is, I believe the number we're looking at right now is 150, which is a significant number and a significant commitment of time.
150 different polygraph tests, is that right?
That's correct.
And how long does a test last for? I mean, is it a 30-minute interview, a one-hour interview?
You know, I don't know the exact time for that, but I would say it's closer to an hour minimum for that test. And certainly by the time you did the preparation for the test, you would be looking at a minimum of an hour.
Right. And without being too graphic, what is the nature of the questions that you ask somebody? Is it where they've been or specifically about their activities, or what are the nature of the questions over the course of that hour?
You know, and I don't know exactly what questions are asked. I can tell you the things that we would look at in general, and that is it would be specific to the offender. And as far as getting into this, if you don't mind, I'll refer this to Director White from Probation Parole, and she can give you that information.
Okay, that would be helpful. Just for a couple of minutes, just to give us a sense of the polygraph exam.
Thank you. This is Donna White. The polygraph is, there's two different types primarily of polygraphs that we use. One is the social history, or the sexual history of the offender. So if we need to find out exactly what his sex offenses have been over the past or his victims, we concentrate on those areas. And the other one is called a maintenance monitoring polygraph. And in that polygraph, we would ask where they've been, if they have had any contact with minors that they're prohibited from having, or have they, you know, been to places where children frequent. The polygraph we only ask three questions at each polygraph.
Ms. White, when I was at this management policy in Little Rock, they said that one of the outcomes of the polygraph exam is that they discover that offenders have had many more relationships, or that it can be pretty jarring when you interview them, that they've been a lot busier than what they've been
charged with.
Thank you for that.
And that is exactly what we have learned from Alaska.
Do we let me ask you another question, because I'm the only one at the table that had the benefit of attending this conference, so I'm just trying to direct the dialogue a little bit. When we do a polygraph exam, one of the things that they discussed at this conference is that they would ask probing questions and determine grade 1 through 6 whether a high, medium, or a low risk sex offender, and they would categorize these sex offenders so that they would be able to use that better to manage the population. Does our polygraph program delve that deeply into making a determination on a grade 1 through 6 high, medium, or low risk sex offender? And do you believe that that contributes to recidivism rates?
Our polygraph does not go into grading 1 through 6, but as sex offender probation officers, we use a risk management tool that's called the Static 99, and that breaks people into low, moderate, or high risk.
That's the same thing that they discussed at this management policy as best practices. So I assume that's part of your best practices program?
It is.
Yes, ma'am.
And that's part of how we determine how much supervision a sex offender takes. And to get to the polygraph questions specifically, the probation officer and the treatment provider get together prior to the polygraphic and discuss what issues are going on currently with that sex offender, and then the questions are developed for the specific area that they're interested in pursuing. The polygraph, really, there's a pre-polygraph where the polygrapher asks just general questions. And then there is the polygraph itself, which has the specific questions which are asked also in the pre-polygraph. And then there's a post-polygraph for further explanation of any questions that may arise.
Representative Holmes.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just curious, since I am new to this and wasn't around for some of the prior discussions, at what point in the process are we giving these tests? When are these occurring?
Ms. White?
Through the chair, the offenders get their polygraph after they're placed on probation or parole supervision. The ones that we currently have been polygraphed under a mandatory parole condition, primarily. So no polygraph is taken for treatment or management purposes until after someone's in the community on supervision.
Ms. White, are you aware how large the population is that would be on probation as a sex offender, and how many people we would want to have in the polygraph program? Because to have two certified polygraphers that cannot yet function on their own, and we're looking at July as the implementation date, and this is February, it just doesn't suggest that we're at all prepared. How large is the population that we would subject to a polygraph exercise?
Well, right now, because we only have the approved providers in Kenai, Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Juneau, those are the sex offenders that would be able to be polygraphed after the 1st of July, and that's probably... I can't give you a number right now.
Are we is asking corrections, is that the right office to go to try and, because we're a little starved for statistics here, which always helps me manage a problem better, to know how large the universe is, you know, per community or across the state, you know, ideally how often we would polygraph these people. If we're using the static 99 test and we're determining low, medium, and high-risk people, would we bring back in high-risk people to be re-polygraphed at what intervals? You know, these are the kind of things that I think we're looking for. And our intention today is to try to lay out what we would like to see happen and to better understand this so that we can really take what we did last year and kind of firm it up as this program is being implemented. Does that sound right to you, Vice Chair? You're nodding your head. Is that?
We can certainly get those numbers for you.
And so that we're clear, and anybody chime in who would like to add into this, but we'd like to know how many there are across the state, how many there are in the areas where we could have professional service them. So Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, Kenai, all of rural Alaska where there's no certified treatment program, how many polygraph people we would like to have, how often high-risk population we would like to see them polygraphed, the medium risk, and maybe the low-risk people don't get polygraphed at all except, you know, when they're initially being assessed. How many people we expect to have trained as professional certified polygraph people by July 1st when this program is implemented. I happen to sit on the finance subcommittee for the University of Alaska. We've got tens of thousands of young people up there, and I know the university just did away with their master's program in therapists in order to pursue a PhD program in therapists, and yet I'm hearing from the Department of Corrections that we need people that have master's degrees to do this. You know, we're not connecting the dots insofar as state resources to address in-state needs that are as immediate as July. I'd like to also understand, we heard that it requires 150 treatment hours in order to get certified to be an in-state expert. But, you know, one of the things that I've learned in my brief time with the legislature is that we have a little bit of a bully pulpit when it comes to making these things happen quicker. And if you would give us some specific instructions, we would certainly like to marshal some resources so that Corrections has the ability to implement the polygraph program to better identify and map out this population. Am I saying the right things, that, or are you guys cringing since we can't see any of you?
We're not cringing. In fact, that's encouraging. We can get that information for you, sir.
Okay. Vice Chair Dahlstrom has some things she'd like to add.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know how many in this room were present in a judiciary meeting about a year and a half ago when we discussed this very subject, and there were some experts that came from out of state that were quite familiar with the polygraph. Department of Corrections had representatives here, and one of the things that was brought up was the issues that do come forward. The chair has just kind of touched on this just a minute ago. When we do these polygraphs and we find out actually how active many people have been, far more active than they may have been thought to have be, or you know, to have been charged with actual offenses, there is an issue in other states, a huge demoralizing issues to the workers that have been involved, social type workers, getting them to this point and them feeling as if you know, they somehow have missed the boat, haven't done their job right, which has caused a lot of problems, and that's something other states are dealing with. So I just bring that forward to, you know, remind us that, I mean, this isn't just polygraph testing and getting the hours in and everything, but we've got to have, as you just stated, all the other dots connected, because, you know, to start this and then to complete something that's so serious, we need to be aware of all the things that are going to come forward.
We're not asking great questions. We're just seem to be asking kind of rhetorical questions here, but we would be very interested in your thoughts, Mr. Bodnick, Ms. White, Mr. Edwards, whatever you have to add. And if you could give us an inventory of things that you would like to see us specifically do or ask for, we would be delighted to assist.
Sure.
Oh, and Representative Lynn?
Yes, I'd like to see what the population of these defendants are under and over age 21, and how many of these defendants are actually students in our public schools.
Do you have records on juvenile sex offenders?
We certainly have records of ages, and we would have to go in and look at the persons under 21 that have been adjudicated to the adult system that were charged with sexual offenses.
We would be pleased not for a lengthy report, but a report that contains a lot of statistics to help us better understand the universe of this population, the regions that they live in, the ages that they are. Is that right, Representative Lynn?
Yes. And I assume the great majority of these, Mr. Chair, would be male offenders, but I'm sure there are female offenders out there also, as we see on the news from time to time.
Yes. So if that's something, we're not looking for a 10-page document as much as we're looking for a couple of pages that would give us the opportunity to understand this population, to see how we're doing on implementing the polygraph program and what we can do to move that along and to work with the University of Alaska in providing, sounds like, a group of people that can become polygraphers. Representative Samus, question? No?
Mr. Chairman, this is John Bodick. I have a couple of legal issues I'd like to make the committee aware of, if I could.
Yes, please.
I believe that we are basing our Alaska model on the state of Colorado, and those are the experts the department brought up last year to testify. I was not a part of that process, but I've been brought up to speed in the last few months as the department has ramped up their polygraph testing mechanisms. I think they're right now on a pilot project where they're testing somewhere short of 30 people. And as the polygraph process goes on, we are learning more and more about the processes, how to better do it, and the issues that have come up. One thing that comes up is what to do when the subject provides information regarding a new offense or behavior that may indicate that a new offense has occurred. We are one of the reporters that are required under statute that Ms. Foster referred to for offenses regarding minors. The commissioner has strongly indicated his desire for probation staff and polygraphers to also report offenses by adult subjects. The problem comes in regard to the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution, which says that the state can't compel individuals to give testimony against them that could lead to prosecution for a new crime. In Colorado, they have elected to provide these offenders with immunity from prosecution for any information they divulge in the polygraph process. What this does is provides the polygrapher with a much greater scope of questions they can ask. In Alaska, we have not elected to provide this kind of immunity. It's a policy matter that the department law has determined is not in the best interest of the state. And I think the commissioner agrees with that. The commissioner Schmidt has determined that he would prefer new offenses to be reported. So the problem with that is under the Fifth Amendment, we cannot require the subject of the polygraph, the probationer or parolee, to provide information that could lead to his or her prosecution for a new offense. And all the subject has to do is claim the Fifth Amendment, and we cannot proceed any further with that question. And if we would proceed with the question, the courts would not allow prosecution based upon that information or based upon the crime that they report they may have perpetrated.
Let me interrupt you for a moment, Representative Samuels.
Yes, thank you. And not being an attorney, it might be a silly question, but could there be a penalty for a failure to comply, simpler as a penalty for a failure to have a breathalyzer done?
Through the chair, I do not believe so. I think that the court said you cannot penalize anyone to make statements against themselves, and the breathalyzer is requiring them to provide physical evidence or submit to the extraction of physical evidence or have a penalty if they refuse to provide it. So it's just one of our basic constitutional tenets that we can't make someone incriminate themselves, and that's exactly what the Supreme Court and our courts have ruled cannot happen in the polygraph process.
Okay, if I could follow up, Mr. Chairman, then as a condition of probation, I mean, if you tacked on longer probationary periods at the end of sentences, could you say as a condition of this is you will provide that, or you're going to throw you back in the pokey for the remainder of your term unless you comply? Is that a possibility?
Through the chair, that is exactly the kind of penalty that the courts have said we cannot threaten the polygraph subject with. We can't say either you answer all the questions or you're revoked and go back to the facility. And we have Alaska Supreme Court cases on that, and the United States Supreme Court cases directly on that subject. So what that means, unlike Colorado, we can't really explore new criminal behavior and we also can't explore the person's full sexual history. And the sexual history is important so that the treatment providers and probation officers can structure mechanisms to prevent the offender from reoffending.
Are we allowed to identify those people as a high-risk sex offender then? Are we allowed to use that information within the context of our assessment? And what is the way that we manage a high-risk offender as opposed to somebody who is assessed as a lower-risk offender?
Mr. Chair, we can't force them to provide this information. So what we have is an offender who pleads the Fifth Amendment, and from that we don't have any more information about their offenses or the nature surrounding their other offenses. Yes, part of the question might be, what do we do then? And I think it's appropriate that we consider those individuals to be untreated, and maybe a way to put it would be not contained in the containment model, and they could be subject to more strict probation supervision because being untrained or untreated and not contained, they create a danger to public safety that we have to address. So I think when someone refuses to answer the questions and pleads the Fifth Amendment, we go on and ask them questions about the offense which they committed and for which they were prosecuted and convicted, and that gives us some information as to the circumstances surrounding their sex offenses and allows us a good start in providing treatment and containment. But those that refuse to answer other questions, it may be appropriate, depending on the severity of their offense and their test on results in the static 99, to ramp up their probation or parole conditions to require perhaps more visits, more home visits, things like that, so we can ensure public safety.
Thank you. Representative Samuels?
Thank you, Mr. Bodick. You mentioned that Colorado can do some things that we can't do, but you also said that the United States Supreme Court had some rulings. So if we had a constitutional amendment, how much would we run into the U.S. Constitution if we chose to try to fix this problem through the Constitution?
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, I don't think we can really affect it. We have this Alaska constitutional prohibition on self-incrimination, which I believe our courts will read more broadly than the U.S. Constitution. But the seminal case in this is Minnesota v. Murphy, which is a United States constitutional case. And therefore, that would provide them at least the same protections against Fifth Amendment and self-incrimination that I've described. Colorado, the reason they can extract more information through the polygraph process is because they've made a policy decision to provide their polygraph subjects with immunity from prosecution for any information they glean. I suppose that's something we could consider, but at this point, we've determined it's not in the best interest of the state to do so.
What would be the benefit from immunity, from granting immunity from prosecution? What would be gained from that? What's that?
I believe, is this Mr. Chairman again?
Yes, sorry about that. What would be gained from offering immunity from prosecution to have their additional crimes on the record?
Mr. Chairman, although we wouldn't be able to prosecute them and incarcerate them for those crimes, if in fact we did get enough information to go forward with the prosecution, we would get more information regarding their sex offenses and sex history, which would allow the probation officers, through the use of the polygraph information, to better supervise these individuals and thereby better protect the public from future crimes. Okay. Now, another way to look at that is if we prosecute them and put them away in jail, that also protects the public by taking them off the streets completely. So there are two ways to protect the public there, two competing ways. And I think at this point we've elected to continue with the notion we still can prosecute them for these crimes and not offer immunity.
Very good. Do you have any other suggestions for us, Mr. Buttock?
I don't really, Mr. Chair. I think that we've got a good model in place here to provide for public protection through this containment model. I do have to say that Colorado's had many years to develop their system, and they've got a really good system from what we've seen, and it's going to take us a while to get our polygraph system off the ground and up and running and work out all the kinks. And again, because of the Fifth Amendment immunity problems or self-incrimination problems, we are not going to have as much information to work with as Colorado, so we start from a bit of a deficit.
Let me ask you just to wind things up, because we want to spend the remaining half hour with Ms. Foster. What can we do in the legislative branch with the university, or can we do independently to help build up this required group of polygraph experts that are certified here in the state of Alaska? How can we facilitate bringing those folks online so that we can at least know who is doing what to whom?
Actually, Mr. Chair, I probably misspoke or was not speaking clearly on who we were getting through the university, and that was the treatment providers rather than the polygraphers. And the we can think about that and certainly put in our report how we believe that you could help us in both cases.
Okay.
And we'll certainly do that, sir.
All right. And how long would it take for you to prepare a report for us like that?
We could have it by midweek, sir, next week.
Oh, that would be terrific. That'd be great. Representative Dahlstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Buttock, just a quick question. You know, we were talking about polygraph folks who are not qualified to do this type of testing, and I'm wondering, I mean, I can think of a couple places in Anchorage right now where, you know, I can see the sign on the door that says they advertise to do polygraphs. Who are they doing polygraphs for? I mean, I know the police department and the fire department bring people in from out of state to do their testing. Who do they offer their services to if they are unqualified to do what you need?
Through the chair, this is John Bodig, and I don't have a real answer to your question, except that I suspect those private folks provide polygraph testing for private entities. And I believe Mr. Edwards has some comment on that.
It's the sex offender specific training, and that is, I mean, we have a number of polygraphers with the various law enforcement agencies around the state who have done you know, hundreds of polygraphs, and even these individuals without additional training and supervision would not be certified to do the sex offender polygraph. It's just a different criteria than the standard polygraph that goes with a criminal investigation or an employment process.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you very much, Ms. White. Thank you very much for your help. We'll look forward to a report and to having the opportunity to try and assist you in your mission. So with that, ladies, if you'll come up here and give us, feel like we're doing a game show or something, deal or no deal.
I like the way you started that, because I'm going to
Yes, Mr. Philbody, come on up.
Come on.
Arpinetti, you're getting all the Department of Law today.
We're so happy. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Rick Sabodny, Chief Assistant Attorney General. I just wanted to talk a little bit about the immunity issue that was discussed. Alaska is in a different position than almost every other state and the federal government. Under federal law, under the U.S. Constitution, if somebody's testimony is compelled, they get what lawyers call use derivative use immunity. That is, we can't use that statement to go out and prosecute the person. We can't use that statement to go out and develop some other evidence if it comes from that statement and prosecute that person. That doesn't mean if a victim of the crime walked in and said, you know, after a person who was polygraphed confessed to sexually assaulting somebody, it doesn't mean that if the victim comes in independently and gives us information, we could go forward with that prosecution. The problem in Alaska, the Alaska Constitution is read more broadly by the Alaska Supreme Court than the U.S. Supreme Court reads the U.S. Constitution, and they say there's something called transactional immunity. You say it, you're out of jail free. You can't do anything about it. That ends it.
Many of us are not big fans of the Alaska State Supreme Court here at this table. Mr. Svodny, not speak for my colleagues, but go ahead, please.
I wanted to explain that that's a difference that we have from Colorado. Colorado can do a couple things. Using a polygraph system there, I mean, they're using it for treatment, and they have taken the public policy decision that statements that are going to be given to them can't be used at a trial. It helps. Their view would be it helps treatment, and it does one other thing. It can identify victims so those victims get treatment. In Alaska, the things that Mr. Bodick talked about are of great concern to me. We are, by this polygraph examination, let me just back up. If we were doing polygraph examinations in jail, I'm less concerned. That person isn't an immediate threat to the public. If we're doing a polygraph exam on probation, and these questions are asked in a yes or no manner. So if you have this question, have you had sex with somebody under 16 in the last 3 months? And the answer is yes. Then what do? We give it, you know, this guy's got immunity. And that's a particular problem that I wanted to address why Alaska was different than some other states, the difference between use immunity and the difference between transactional immunity. But the good news is Ms. Carpinetti's got a list of things that may help.
Well,
yes, and just for the record, my prior remarks, of course, excluded Justice Carpinetti.
He was not on the Supreme Court when the decision came out.
Mr. Chairman, five of us were discussing some of the suggestions that we had that we could offer here. Of course, we would like some time to powwow with other members of the prosecution and come up with more comprehensive suggestions, but this is what we came up with in our time in your office. And one of them, the first one would be to make probation sex offenders who are on probation who start exhibiting precursor type behavior that we know may lead to recidivism and that are against their conditions of probation, make that behavior a separate crime so that the person could be charged with not moving away without telling his or her probation officer, which is, sometimes is a step in down the path of violating your probation and recidivating. That's one suggestion. We tried to make all suggestions that wouldn't cost money, but we couldn't do that. So we have some that do. And one of them is significant extra resources for investigation in rural areas of the state. Even in villages or communities that have their own local police department have specially trained investigators to help on a regular basis.
Mr. Chairman, sure. Just make a point about that. I mean, I've done some prosecutions of sexual assault cases in the rural areas, and I wanted to point out when Ms. Foster was testifying, it's worse on victims there. I mean, what happens if you're in Bethel and there was a rape in the village? They're calling up and interviewing these people by phone. it's a, you know, instead of getting on the airplane and going out and talk to him. So somebody who's been raped, they're getting a phone call from somebody they have no idea who they are. I mean, they say they're the state trooper, and they're asking them about very intimate questions. So it's very expensive if you're going to do it correctly, if you're going to do a good investigation, and it's very expensive to do, because we want to do those first-hand interviews, first-person interviews, instead of over the phone, both for the sake of the victim and the sake of the investigation. Sorry.
Sure. Knowing that there are big holes in prosecution and investigation of sex offenders, we would suggest that we get more of the people that are directly involved in it together, including victim advocates, treatment people, investigators, prosecutors, and medical people together to identify where the biggest problems are, what the biggest needs in the overall picture of the solving this problem. And finally, we think it would be important to revisit the issue of having sex offender treatment in jails. Some of the people who are sex offenders who are incarcerated are going to be there for a long time, but most of them are going to come out. And in many communities, there aren't sex offender treatment. And according to what we've learned, there's a continuum of treatment. The more you get, the earlier, the better. So we think that would be a good thing to look at again. Those are our suggestions.
San Diego has they have a program. It's called the SAFE Task Force. It stands for the Sexual Assault Felony Enforcement. And I believe, Ms. Foster, that it's different than the SART group that we were talking about before. The Sexual Assault Felony Enforcement Task Force, the SAFE Task Force, they have two missions in San Diego. One is they surveil high-risk sexual offenders to, you know, determine where they're going and what they're doing with regard to this precursors that you're talking about. And the second thing they do is they do arrests of people that aren't current on their sex offender registration. To use the word successful, because I haven't been impressed with anything that we've discussed to call it successful. A program like that, is that valuable? It seems to dovetail into the discussion that you had about demonstrating precursor behavior and sex offenders that are moving away without telling their probation officers where they're going and what they're doing. This issue of sex offenders going underground so that we don't know where they are. Is that helpful, Ms. Foster?
Mr. Chair, it's wonderfully helpful, and the success those programs are having is real. Again, however, they are doing that within a confined geographical area where they could almost put a fence around their borders and, you know, check if they had enough resources. And that's not Alaska. I mean, that's Anchorage and maybe Fairbanks, but even our large communities serve vast, lightly populated rural surrounding areas, and so they're very labor intensive. But it's kind of like when the troopers or other law enforcement will have their DUI checkpoint times or their extra enforcement on holidays. The more officers you've got out there looking for a certain offense being committed, the more we're going to catch. So surveillance of these offenders, you know, can be very effective, and checking up on them. Sometimes when I've got a sex offender who's out on bail, I'll ask the local law enforcement if they're just have a patrol officer out and it's a light night, just go knock on the door and see if he's there. It's not often that they're able to comply with my request, but when they do, it's amazing how many times they're not where they're supposed to be, and so they can be charged. But again, labor intensive, and that translates into expensive. But they're very good models, and I think it's not inappropriate at all for us to look at those models and see what can we take from them and adapt the concept of surveillance, the concept of these checks, you know, watching them, maybe finding a way to get people in villages who will report. I mean, I don't know how it would work out, but I do think there's components of that we should look at.
One thing I would add, it's also a crime in Alaska to fail to register as a sex offender when you're under duty to do so.
It's a crime to fail to register or to maintain, I assume, to maintain your current address and your current employer.
Well, that's one of, excuse me, Mr. Chair, that's one of the definitions of failure to register would be failing to notify when you've changed residence, failure to notify when you have, you know, moved from one place to another, and there's a variety of things, and they have to do it at minimal quarterly or yearly, depending on their offense. So that's part of the definition of.
Representative Alstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm assuming that that is not enforced because we don't have enough officers to enforce it. I mean, I know it's not enforced. There was a time last year my husband and I sat down and looked at the sex offendery list just in our area, and I made a phone call and said, this person works at this restaurant, this person works at this dry cleaners, I see this person at this place all the time, and I kept seeing them on the street after that. I don't believe they were ever, you know, nothing happened.
Well, through the chair, two things come to mind is, one, they may not have been violation just because they're out and about. I mean, if they had done, say, for example, if they have to register annually where they live and work, if that hadn't changed, they wouldn't necessarily be in violation. We do enforcement of it because there are people charged regularly with failure to register is the offense. But it's often an offense that we catch when the person is picked up or contacted for something else. It's very hard to affirmatively do that. But a lot of people who are charged with criminal trespass, disorderly conduct, as soon as they're contacted by law enforcement and they make their check to see if there's any warrants out for them, will find that the sex offender registry people have put a notice in the computer, this person is out of compliance, they didn't show up. And that goes in the computer. It doesn't mean somebody necessarily goes looking for them, but when they're contacted is usually the time when we get those charges, and we do prosecute them.
So just a quick follow-up. So when it says whereabouts unknown on that sex offender list, that doesn't necessarily mean that that person's out of compliance?
Sure.
Is that correct?
Through the chair, no, that means they're out of compliance. They need to be providing a street address where they live. The problem is people who just live on the street. That is an issue in how to deal with those particular people.
And those are the folks that I'm talking about that I had made a phone call about.
Right. Representative Lynn?
Yes, about 2 years ago, I had a good neighbor move away, and somebody else moved in. And through a series of circumstances, well, I usually check these sex offender lists. I don't want to have a political sign in some sex offender's yard. So, you know.
Unless it's a really good street corner.
Unless really good street, yeah. But to my amazement, I found out that a neighbor catty corner across the street was a sex offender, but was out of compliance. He had not moved. So way back in September, September 60 was, I called and reported this. And through some other unrelated activities, I checked the thing again just a couple of weeks ago, and sure enough, it still had not checked in. It's still on the computer. So I did call other people, and I've got to check and see if they've ever updated the computer, I brought him into compliance, or fixed whatever needed to be fixed. But this is the case where, you know, I turned that in September, and I happened to go back to it a couple of weeks ago because of some other things that went on, and there he is, still not registered. It said, if you know where this fellow is, give us a call. Well, I called back in September. Nothing had been done. So I guess this fellow can be arrested, correct?
Correct.
And through the chair, I've had the same experience when we had a guy arrested for crime X, and I have the file, and I just checked myself exactly what you did and saw that he was out of compliance. And I had a devil of a time getting an officer to set aside a half an hour to an hour to write up a complaint, order the paperwork from them, and get over another charge. And that's probably where it's sticking when those reports are made from citizens. I had a little more access to harass that officer to get a report in, but I'm sure that happens.
I mean, the first report I made as a citizen, the second report I made as a legislator.
Mr. Spondy, Susan Parks told me last year that the average offender offends 100 times before they're caught. And I imagine the statistic, as startling as it is not that much different than drunk drivers who are like, oh, God, this is the first time I ever had too much to drink.
And only two beers.
Yes, right. But my question that I'd like to ask you with a couple of the remaining minutes that we have is, and we discussed this a little bit earlier informally. Tell me about juvenile sex offenders and juvenile on juvenile sex offense. So we had a case up in Fairbanks where a 12-year-old had raped another 12-year-old. And what do we do about managing that population? Because one of the things that we learned at this conference was that the professional term that was used is that adult males who are often the rapists often retire out of rape because of their testosterone levels or their physical size, agility, etc. But that pedophiles continue to be fascinated with three-year-olds well into, regardless of gender, well into their 70s and 80s. What happens to juvenile sex offenders? Because it's an illness, do they grow up to be adult sex offenders? And if we don't treat them as juveniles, then do we expose them to the adult population, or as adults, do we expose them to the juvenile population until such time that they're caught?
There's a lot of parts to that question, and I think Ms. Parks is telling you, I mean, some people would say she was lowballing it. Well, that's a wrong expression. Some people would say that that statistic is low, that it's a lot higher than that. To deal with the juvenile offenders in most, well, large urban communities generally have a facility or oftentimes have a facility that specifically deals with children who have either exhibited sexual behavior that suggests that they're offending and they've done something else that have got them into the system, or have been adjudicated delinquent as a sex offender. For example, this community has a residential treatment center that deals specifically with kids. The younger kids, I think the kids that you've had a concern about and been discussing, you know, the 12-year-olds, the 8-year-olds, we're in a way a resource-poor state with people who are doing that type of treatment. But I think, you've hit the nail on the head. If we don't deal with those kids in treatment, we're almost guaranteed that as an adult they're going to be offending. And I can almost guarantee you now that if you have an 8-year-old who's offending against another 8-year-old, we got another sex offender out there who was a parent or who had access to that 8-year-old earlier.
Mr. Chair, just a comment for the record. You know, we could spend days on this too, but you know, is this an illness or is it a core deficiency in their system? You know, I don't know what the answer is, but
nature,
we could spend
days
debating just that.
Well, can we ask you through the Department of Law, as we did with Department of Corrections, that we're not looking for a lengthy report, but really a compass or a guide of where we might go, so that legislatively we might add things that would be practical and helpful, either in our capacity to make statute changes, or in our capacity just to kind of push and bully the system to get the output that we want. You know, for many of us to sit down with members of the university, for instance, and to identify the fact that we need 24 people that are capable of being trained professional polygraph experts within the next 2 years out of the university. And what can you do, President Hamilton, to help us output those people? They're neither engineers or scientists or ready to build a gas line, but by God, they can keep our streets safer. And I know, as a member of the Finance Subcommittee on the University, Mr. Coghill, that's one of the things I've been banging a drum on, is we've got a lot of the soft jobs that aren't resource related, where we need a lot of help in this. We need a lot of help in this state, and that is, I found, a unique ability in the legislature is it may take 21 or 11 votes to pass a law, but each of us independently are capable of stopping a moving train when it comes to saying, hey, we need this resource redirected to this place. And the University of Alaska sounds like it could be contributing to me, it sounds like the University of Alaska could be contributing to safer communities and a better management of this population by outputting people in some fields that could be especially helpful where we are clearly identifying a deficiency. And that's outside of statute, but that certainly is within our ability to sit down and discuss with Pete Kelly and members of the university. We need people in this degree field that can help us. And I feel woefully deficient of having statistics, as we stated earlier, with corrections. So I'll politely charge you with the same task on behalf of this committee. Please provide us with some statistics and with a universe of offenders by communities and numbers of people that we need to help solve this problem in specific degree fields that can do things so that we can either follow up with the university this year or in January, February of 2008 when we're still here and we can, frankly, we can ask the university to come before the Judiciary Committee and ask them how they're doing in providing these folks to help law enforcement do this. It doesn't do us a darn bit of good to have a need for 20 polygraphers and have one or two or have to fly somebody in from Washington.
They're going to go out of state.
And frankly, I share the vice chair's offense that we've got people that are the victims of violent crime, sexual crime in nature, and they're being interviewed telephonically to address, you know, things of such a personal nature. And that's an area where we really can nudge the process along quite nicely without necessarily having to create something in the statute book. So is that something that I know you're overburdened, your department is already, but we'd like to help move the football, really.
I think the way you formulated what you want, we can get you fairly rapidly. That is the number of sexual assault cases, sexual abuse of minor cases per community.
Anything that you can provide us would be helpful. We'd like to come back and readdress this. And as I say, I know that Senator French shares this passion for this vulnerable subset. So do you have anything that you'd like to say?
Chair, if I could just offer one very, very brief anecdote, which
you could take your time, Ms. Foster.
This is very brief. About 4 years ago, I was screening a sex abuse of a minor case, and we have a cover sheet, an intake sheet that has basic information, and I looked at the date of birth, and it was 1914. And I'm thinking, this World War I, this offender was still, and he did have two prior convictions in the state of Alaska, but he was still offending at his advanced age. So,
and if I could just make just one final remark, because we're on the record here, and this, you know, few people watch gavel to gavel. Ms. Foster, you've been doing this on and off for a long time. I went to a 1.5 day conference, and I had to take a walk. There was not a ray of light in that facility with such dark subject matter. And I just want to thank you in my capacity as an elected official, and I'm sure I echo the sentiments of others. You are doing God's work to help protect a very vulnerable a community of people, and I'm speaking about the victims and those that don't feel safe until many years later to report a crime, and you pursue offenders of a very vulnerable population. And I want to thank you on behalf of my community, on behalf of this committee, on behalf of the state of Alaska. It is hard work, and at the end of the day, it's hard to save a life in your profession, but I'm sure that you have saved many, and I just want to thank you, and I see that you want to echo those sentiments.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Lynn.
I underline what you just said, but I also like to congratulate you and thank you for bringing this subject before the committee. I think you're also doing God's work in doing this, and I think education for all of us, and I think I'm very, very happy to be in this committee when we're addressing issues like this.
Well, and thank you also for your support. The legislative changes over the last few years, the support for CACs has been enormous. It's very helpful, and so we also thank you for responding when you have information in front of you.
Anybody else? Great. Thank you very much. We're adjourned at 3 o'clock. Thank you for coming down.